Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Michael Pilarski, a permaculture practitioner and teacher from the Western United States. Michael also wildcrafts and forages for wild foods. Our conversation today brings together the interviews with Arthur Haynes, Sam Thayer, Wilson Alvarez, and Ben Wise about our use of the wildlands and interacting with the edge between the world built by man, the natural world, and the interface between permaculture and the wilderness. If you're relatively new to the show, I'd recommend listening to those episodes before settling in to this time with Mr. Pilarski. You'll find links in the show notes to each of those. If you find this or the other interviews helpful, please lend me a hand as this program depends on your support. Find out more at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to my interview with Michael Pilarski. I'll join you again afterwards with some more information and updates. Well then, Michael, if you're ready to begin, could you give us some of your background and biography and how you came to do what you do?
Scott, I'm happy to talk with you, and I have this message for the world I've been trying to get out, and this will help a bit. And knowing my background would probably help. To go back to a long ways ago, in the fourth grade, I decided I wanted to become a naturalist, a natural scientist, and study nature and be a teacher. And I played in the woods when I was a young person. I got to spend a lot of time in the outdoors in northern Michigan. And I worked on farms. I started working in the second grade, picking strawberries out in the fields with the Mexicans and other poor people. And so I spent a lot of time in nature in those years. And I also learned how to work. And I also learned how to pick things really fast, which really became a great asset to me in my later life here. I eventually went to, grade school, high school, got into college, and I dropped out of college once I became radicalized during the Vietnam War era. And I left that career path I had set for myself of being a naturalist and became instead a radical that wanted to change society because I saw a lot of problems. It's interesting that later, not that long afterwards, in my early 20s, I went out and became an organic farmer and started interfacing with nature again. And of course, I also became a professional fruit picker for 18 years. It was the way I made income. I worked 2 months of the year for income, and the other 10 months, I just did whatever I wanted to because I was in charge of my own life. I haven't had a job since I was in my early 20s, for the system. And the farming really satisfied me. And when I came across permaculture in approximately 1981, I started writing and learning about permaculture. I took my first permaculture design course in 1982 with Andrew Jeeves and Bill Mollison, and then a further course with Bill Mollison in 86, and started teaching permaculture in 1988 as full design courses. Somewhere in there, in the mid-70s, I learned about a man named Richard St. Barb Baker, and he inspired me to start an organization called Friends of the Trees Society. And my goal was to help double the world's forest cover, or that's what the organization's goal was. And so ever since then, I've been on one of the goals of what I do is to help reforest the world. Now, that is reached a lot of nuances, I would say, over the years. It's become more complex than in those early years. And I'll come back to that in a few minutes about the doubling the world's forest cover. But other things that happened in my learning phase during this whole long time period is that I became real interested in ethnobotany, which is the study of indigenous people's uses of plants. And that led into the study of ethnoecology, which is how did native peoples actually affect the environment around them? Because we generally think of them as passive takers of harvest that they could find, but they were generally at the mercy of Mother Nature. But actually, indigenous people became very skilled at manipulating their environment and making it much more full of food than it normally would be. In other words, nature was as we now know, when the Europeans came to the United States, North America was this beautiful place full of game and fish and big trees and harvests of nuts and berries. It was a beautiful landscape and very productive. And it was actually a managed environment by the native peoples here. And since then, once we got a lot of the native peoples out of the way, their management system was toppled, and the landscape has become, in a sense, impoverished, or at least changed to a great deal. And so later I'll talk a little bit more about restoration ecology, and I'll come back to this topic. Other things that I became interested in over the last number of years is wildcrafting, and I've become a professional wildcrafter. So I actually go out in nature and I wildcraft mainly medicinal plants, some edible plants. And so I can really empathize with hunter-gatherer societies, because I am now at least a gatherer. And so that's helped inform my particular take on things. I also did research and published a book on called Restoration Forestry, an International Guide to Sustainable Forestry Practices. So I studied forestry management from a worldwide perspective. What would we need to do to put forestry back on a better tack? You know, how do we improve the forest situation through forest management? So all these things and more have really gelled together in my head to give me a relatively unique perspective on the world's problems and where do we need to go. How can we fix the situation? And I would state that we have enough information that we know we can fix the world as far as in the physical characteristics. We can get the climate back to a nice interglacial period. We can stabilize the climate. We can have all the food we need to feed even as large a population as we have now. We could have great ecosystems functioning in a great way, the oceans, the rivers, the prairies. Humans could have a great life on a great earth, and we wouldn't need to fight resource wars, etc. And we know how to do that, or at least we know enough that we know how to design that in. So we have that at our fingertips, you might say, but of course it's the social systems and humanity's inhumanity demand that stands in the way. How do we fix people? How do we fix the mental problems that we have? Greed and anger and wars and all that. And so that's really I can't say I have all the answers to that. So today I'll probably mainly focus on what are the answers to our giant questions that humanity faces at this time with this background I have. So anyway, I guess that's a little bit of my background. How's that sound?
That sounds pretty good and fairly diverse as well. I don't know that I've met or talked to anyone who really came directly to the path that they're on with permaculture and restoration of any kind in a real direct way. It seems that all of these other pieces added up to the person who they are in trying to build a better world.
Mm-hmm. I didn't mention, actually, that I had been studying restoration ecology a lot and how do we restore ecosystems and help put on the Inland Northwest Restoration Conference some years back. So I'm weaving together the restoration ecology, the indigenous people, ethnoecology, and permaculture. And so that's my particular little angle that I have brought together here.
When we were putting together this interview, the kind of working title that I've been running with is The Interface Between Wildcrafting, Permaculture, and Restoration Ecology. Could you give a little bit more of an understanding of what wildcrafting is?
Well, wildcrafting is how humans have made their living, so to speak, or got their sustenance, you know, for tens of thousands of years until they discovered agriculture. And there's always this common conception that lives were nasty, brutish, and short during the hunter-gatherer phase, and then things become much more cultured and civilized, and people had more to eat when they discovered agriculture. But what the anthropologists, archaeologists are now actually fighting, actually quite the opposite, that the work of Dr. Weston A. Price, for instance, is fairly well known. And he found in his studies of indigenous people around the world that they pretty much, without exception, were very healthy, had great physiques, and very sharp, very healthy people eating the diet that they did. And that when we discovered agriculture, that a lot of people started having a lot of degenerative diseases. Stature went down. The mouth wasn't as good, not as full of a mouth, great, not as good as teeth. And so agriculture, and there was periodic famines in agricultural societies, and culture is good, but there's been a lot of haves and have-nots in our cultural history since we discovered agriculture. So agriculture, you might say, is not all that it's cracked up to be. And of course, today we have the problem with GMOs and toxins and poisons in the food and demineralized food, and our food supply is actually probably about the worst it's ever been in the world. And so our high civilization has actually been leading us down the wrong path on food. Now, I just finished reading a book on the crossover between medicinal food, or between food and medicine. It was about medicinal food, and it's a study of indigenous cultures in different parts of the world, including a lot of agricultural cultures. It's become clear to me that even today, most indigenous agriculture societies, or traditional agricultural societies, they still do a lot of wildcrafting. The people do not just rely on agriculture alone in most traditional societies where people are doing subsistence or family agriculture. And in Nepal, for instance, it's stated that for every acre of farmland, and generally their farms are only an acre or two in size in terms of the cultivated area, they need 2.5 acres of woodland to go for wild foods, for fertilizers, things to help feed the cow, handicrafts. In other words, the wild or the non-cultivated areas are very important to their overall livelihood. And generally, this is still found worldwide. You can go to Spain and you can go to various places where the traditional culture is still intact. As they become part of the globalized economy, there's less of that. And furthermore, a lot of these wild foods are way more nutritious than what people are growing on their farm. So any modern person out there listening to this, they would be well advised to go out and learn what the wild edibles and the weeds, the edible weeds, et cetera, are around them, and they'll have a much more nutritious diet. And there's a lot of medicinal elements, generally speaking, in those wild berries, those wild greens, those wild roots, some more than others. We have put a big dichotomy. It's like there's medicine and there's food. But when we really start studying food, we learn that there's a huge amount of medicinal value or health value to the food we eat. And so wild ones are great. So I go out and I wildcraft all the time. I traverse everywhere I go. I'm basically doing a wild plant inventory as I drive down the highway. I was just yesterday driving around the Flathead Lake and up into the Rocky Mountains and doing plant surveys. Now, everywhere I go, I see food. In fact, here's the figures for the temperate zone. And wherever I've traveled, I've done a lot of plant walks. And I'll catalog every plant species that I can find on a particular walk. And generally, I'll find 50 to 100 species on any particular given walk. And generally, over 50% of those plants are medicinal, and generally 15 to 25%, sometimes higher, have edible food value. And it's interesting, reading that book made me realize that when I make my list of what's edible and what's medicinal of that particular plant survey, I find that a lot of them are edible and medicinal uses for a particular plant. In fact, it's very common. And then to back up a little bit and give this other perspective, I've learned in permaculture that we can design systems that are full of food, and that can be in our yards, along the streets, in the alleys, in our gardens, in the general landscape. just as the Native Americans did and the indigenous people did, we can help load the ecosystem, the wild ecosystem, with foods for ourselves, foods and medicines. And so now I think we can get to the point where we can design our cities, our yards, and you know, our farms, et cetera. We can design them in to have a lot of wild foods and way more than they would normally have, and that we can return, in a sense, more to a hunter-gatherer lifestyle. Not that we're moving around in tribes or anything. We can have our houses, but we go around our landscape and we can collect wild foods or semi-wild foods rather than just growing them in our gardens or farms. And so that more of our food supply will become wild again, will be richer in nutrition, medicinal food elements, and produce happier, healthier human beings. And in the process of doing this, we can restore ecosystem function, because so many of our ecosystems have lost parts of their function and are not functioning well. So we need to restore ecosystem function at the same time as we increase the amount of food and other useful plants in the landscape so that humans don't need to have so much of the land in cultivated agricultural settings. In other words, part of our farms can become wilder. I always say this to any group. We can take 50% of the land currently in agriculture in the world and put it back into wild ecosystems. Doing so with a good permaculture and ethnoecology designs, we can have a lot more room in the world for all the other species. We will actually have more food and healthier lifestyles, et cetera, to do so. So take 50% of the land out of agriculture that's currently in agriculture, and we'll be better off at the end of it if we do it with all this permaculture restoration ethnoecology in mind. So that's a big statement. I don't think anybody else in the world is saying that.
So then when it comes to removing that agricultural land from production and creating a more productive ecosystem through restoration and permaculture and wildcrafting, how do you envision a world like that looking?
Well, it's going to take a little while to get there, maybe a generation or two. And we wouldn't start by taking the best agricultural land out of production and be, you know, generally the more marginal land. Although we would probably say that in every farm, it's not taking the land out of production, it's taking it out of cultivation, because we can have it very productive without cultivation. It becomes more wild, becomes more self-regenerating. You know, instead of us planting everything all the time, it's sort of planting itself once you get a good system going. And I guess to really talk about this more, I'm going to have to go into the topic a little bit of employment. What is useful work? I've been doing a lot of studying of economics lately, too, the last number of years. And it doesn't take too deep of a study of the economic situation to realize, or the employment situation from a permaculture perspective at any rate, to realize that approximately 50% of the people in the world aren't doing any useful work. And it's probably a higher figure than that. You know, we have unemployment at high rates, official and non-official. If we look carefully, we could realize really quickly that a lot of people that are employed and receiving paychecks aren't really doing anything useful for the world or for their fellow human beings or for the earth. They're mainly just taking, they're getting their paychecks, but they're not doing anything useful. And I don't want to get into like who those are, but there's a lot of paper shufflers out there. There's a lot of the money industry, you might say, aren't really doing anything useful. I consider people that grow food and produce useful items as doing productive work. Anyway, there's a huge amount of people. Some societies, in some places, you know, it's officially 50% unemployment. Anyway, there's a huge amount of people. There's a huge labor force out there that are still all eating. You know, some of them not very well, mind you, but there's a huge amount of the world's population that I really have a lot of time on their hands, you might say, or could be doing something more productive. And to do the restoration of the Earth's environments that I'm talking about. It's going to take some effort. It isn't just walking away from a place, but what can humans do to help ecosystems? And there's very, very few people that are actually involved in planting trees, cleaning up waterways, fixing soils, planting forests, et cetera, that actually are going to restore the ecosystem. So the thing is, it's going to take a fairly good workforce. I've done the figures, and it's something like, you know, it's pretty much like 5% of the workforce is all it would take to fix up the world. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done that isn't being done, and there's, of course, a huge amount of work that doesn't need to be done that is being done. So we just need to tweak the world's labor force to some extent to this, that a lot more of them are working with the land and helping the land. So it's going to take some people. So fixing up the Earth is one of the biggest jobs facing humanity, and it's going to take a lot more labor force than we're currently allocating for it. The other really big job that needs to be done is fixing up humanity or healing humanity. There's a huge amount of broken down humans out there, and there's a huge amount of ill health and mental ill health. You don't have to look very far in American society around you to say, oh my gosh, there's a lot of walking wounded out there, and a lot of people are there in the process of dying, and there's a lot of different types of health care that could help these people. So we need a lot more of our unemployed, so to speak, or misemployed people working on helping heal humans mentally and physically, which goes back to how do we cure the social system. So to get back to your question, what would that world look like? It would mean that there's a lot more people working with the land, helping, you know, with the planet, and a lot more people working with helping heal people, and there'd be a whole lot less money speculation and military running around messing things up. I would think that one of the things that would this world would look like, I oftentimes, less than 50% of Americans currently own their own homes. More than not, people are renters, especially young people. And they move relatively rapidly from one place to another. They don't have much incentive to improve where they're living. And so things generally are deteriorating in the whole rental market scene. Imagine if every single place, dwelling, had a permaculture design done for it, and the people that lived there were planting fruit trees and gardens, you know, fixing up the buildings, putting in renewable energy systems, water catchments off the roof so that the yard would be watered off the roof. We would eventually, these properties that are designed and managed with permaculture in mind, permaculture properties, would become full of food and lovely places to live. As one renter moved to another place, they would move into a place that was already fully functioning, well set up, very productive, etc. And if we had a healthy mindset, you know, in our population, everybody would be taken care of where they're at. And no matter where you moved, you would be moving to another piece of paradise. And so everywhere would look really good. Everywhere could be really productive. And so just think of a world like that, where every single place, every single house, when someone was no longer able to care for their house, they get elderly or they die, whoever moves into that place inherits something that is just spectacular. So that is exciting to think of. Everywhere you go, everywhere is, in a sense, functioning really well. And that's certainly a far cry from what we see today. Anyway, there's a couple of thoughts there. And as I mentioned, everywhere you go, there would be healthy forests, healthy waterways, pleasant places to live. There wouldn't be concrete jungles as we currently have today and slums. You know, there's a lot of, you know, the percentage of people living in slums in the world right now is very high and going up. No doubt that humanity is going on a downward spiral, and that the Earth itself, the health of the ecosystems, is on a downward spiral. It doesn't take a whole lot of thought to see that those two downward spirals are going to bring us down, you know, humanity down really hard. And so we know what we need to do to reverse those spirals. And more people, I think, are getting it. Hopefully your podcast and your work will help reach a few more people so that more and more people start being the change that's needed instead of being the problem. At any rate, it's going to be a tight call no matter what happens, whether we can salvage the current civilization such as it is really doubtful. But out of the ashes or the crashes, hopefully the survivors will want to go the better way. I mean, we could turn it around without crashes and ashes, but at the moment it certainly doesn't look good.
The amount of work to steer the ship in another direction at this moment would be a very monumental task.
Oh, yeah. It's like society, as we're getting greener and more people are interested in the environment, so I always like to use the assembly of like humanity's all crammed in this car heading for a cliff at a pretty fast rate of speed. And everybody's got their hands on the wheel a little bit. And the wheel is turning greener and a little bit more to the left as maybe people are trying to put the brakes on a little bit and turn away from the cliff. But the momentum and the trajectory is certainly really heading for the cliff. And so the more people that can help put the brakes on the bad stuff and start turning the wheel to a greener direction, maybe we can stop the car before it goes over a cliff. We'll see. But, at least young people today are probably going to find out in their lifetime. I used to think this was going to be happening much more rapidly than it is. Now that I'm 65, I've watched a huge amount of change in my life, and I've seen a lot of positive things happening. But the Earth itself, what we're doing to the Earth and our resources is really pretty dire. And could I maybe talk about forests for a few minutes here? There's a point I wanted to get across. Now, I said a while back that one of my goals early in life when I started Friends of the Tree Society was to double the world's forest cover. And in a sense, we could say, well, that is doubling the acreage of trees. And that's part of the picture. And we could also say, well, it's a doubling of the number of trees, and that's certainly not necessarily true because, I've seen pictures of Weyerhaeuser Timber Company or a little ad saying, for every tree we cut down, we plant two. And so maybe they cut something down that's, like 200 years old and weighs, many tons, and they plant two little baby trees that weigh an ounce each. And it's not there are maybe twice as many trees in the world, but we certainly lost a lot of ground there. So what I realized is that what we need to do is we need to double the weight of the world's forests. Generally, forests are in short rotations. They don't let trees get as big as they used to. There's a lot of more forest fires in the world today. There was just some huge forest fires in Indonesia lately, as they burn more and more of their forests to put in oil palm plantations. So even though in some places the forest cover is going up, the total amount of biomass held in the forest has been going down, down, down. We need to reverse that trend and tie up that carbon. We can tie up enough carbon by letting the forest get bigger and healthier and weightier and have more biomass in them. And so that's a really big thing we need to do in the world. Let the forest get bigger and heavier, more biomass on the ground, more snags, bigger trees. And so that is going to take, again, there's human management involved in that because of the current bad forest management in so much of the world now. Forest fires are taking a large part of more and more of the forest out, or they don't necessarily take the forest out because they regrow, but there's a huge loss in biomass. A lot of carbon goes up in the atmosphere in those forest fires. So at the time being, we need in the West here, we need some controlled burning and some fires, but we need to do forest management in a way that really reduces the amount of forest fires we're having in our ecosystems for the next while. We can't just wantonly keep burning and cutting down our forests. We need to double the weight of the world's forest. That's a really big thing we can do. A corollary thing we can do to really improve the world's climate is to probably we'll need to a factor of maybe 2 to 10 times, change the amount of carbon held in all the world's agricultural soils. And there's a lot of soils in the world that are being used for agriculture or gardening or lawns that humans are managing and have a very low carbon content or humus content now. And if we could take all the agricultural soils of the world and within 4 to 10 years of good soil management, we know how to do this, we can double the humus content on these soils. That would be a huge tie-up of carbon very rapidly. Pull a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere. Another great upshot of that is that the food becomes more nutritious, there's less erosion, the yields of the agricultural systems would go up. So increasing the humus content in our agricultural soil is one of the imperative and one of the more easily available ways that we can get ourselves out of this mess that we're in, including the climate changes. So start with the agricultural soils. Is that something that can be done quickly at the same time as we're increasing the weight of the forest? And presto, in probably 30 years or so, and I haven't got all the figures on that, we could tie up that excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and stabilize our current runaway global climate change, which is hammering the world, the world's infrastructure, and the world's capacity to grow food, et cetera. I mean, you know, people say, well, is climate change happening? I say, I am watching global food production around the world in different ecosystems and, you know, different countries, and agriculture is getting hammered. And so we better get things fixed up.
So then two of your strategies to do so and to restore some of our ecosystems, decrease the carbon content, is to build soil and increase the amount of biomass in our forests.
Yes, very much so. And as I said, if you increase humus content in soils, you also greatly reduce erosion. And so flooding is a really big problem in the world today, and all you have to do is look at the flooding around the world in this last June alone, and it's mammoth. How do you increase that carbon in the soil? You know, it's a complex thing. There's some things that are relatively simple, but swales, key line systems, and there's various soil techniques we can use to stop erosion, or, you know, usually it's slow down at first and then stop. There's a natural bit of erosion, but human accelerated erosion is a very big problem in the world, and we need to be able to fix that erosion. And there's a lot of different techniques and strategies we can use to do that. And we know how to do it. We know how to stop erosion and this flooding that's hammering cities and cultures all around the world. And so along with doubling the humus content in the soil is also the associated strategies that stop erosion, these big floods events. And of course, you know, doing tree planting and reforestation plays a big part in that too. So all these things are going together: stop erosion, build forests, and build soils. And permaculture, of course, studies these things astutely in cultures and countries all around the world. Permaculturists are not the only people working on these problems, but we're keeping an eye on all the other, you might say, keeping an eye on and synthesizing the work of soil scientists and forest activists, et cetera. You know, all the people that are working on the solutions. It isn't just permaculturists doing the good work. It's just that probably more than any other group on earth or discipline, we're trying to create syntheses out of the best of what's going on. So we're not the end-all, be-all, but we have a lot to contribute to the conversation, you might say.
If you will, permaculture practitioners are kind of on the forefront of implementing many of these ideas.
Yes. I wish I could say that every permaculture was implementing, but I just wrote a sentence in some writing I just did yesterday. I said, well, many permaculturists are working with gardening or farming or managing pieces of land but not all of them. And so it's an interesting question. How many people that are trained as permaculturists are actually doing on-the-ground work? It's a pretty high percentage, I imagine. I would suspect maybe 50% or something like that. Many of them are doing other useful work in other arenas, you know, putting in new economic systems evolve or organizing things or networking or doing podcasts such as you. I don't know if you have your own garden or not, but many permacultures are actually, their hands are dirty. They're on the ground doing things. So a lot of us are, and we're helping create some of the models, or you might say we're creating some of the solutions, or you could also say that we're making some of the mistakes so that other people don't have to make them because, you know, it's a trial error kind of thing. Yes, permaculturists have a lot of on-the-ground models to look at, and it's been a small enough movement so far that we're still, you know, a drop in the bucket. But if we could scale up the work of permaculturists 100 times, wow, then we're really going to start seeing things. And permaculture has definitely made some inroads. I would say that probably more than any other country, Australia, of course, where permaculture was founded, is very well known, and there's a lot of people working in permaculture there. But if you look at South Africa, the school system there has really embraced permaculture. There's some great YouTubes on the internet. You can go and see that, you know, that permaculture is in hundreds and hundreds or thousands of schools in South Africa where it's being taught because the children are growing some of their own food in their school gardens, et cetera, and it's really starting to make a difference there because it's just in the last 10 years this has all happened in South Africa, maybe a little bit longer, but that's not a very long time. So all the children that are growing up learning about permaculture and growing food permaculture ways, et cetera, they are going to be the adults in the not-too-distant future, and they can start having a much bigger impact because it was in the schools. South Africa is sort of an impressive story there with permaculture.
And that's one of the ways where I think that multi-generational societal shift for this comes in is by teaching children so that they don't necessarily think of the world in permaculture terms. They just live it. That it's not a conscious thing. It's just a part of how they interact with the world.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like when you study indigenous and traditional societies, you realize that most people knew what medicines they needed to take, you know, just local medicinal plants and foods pretty much took care of most health problems at a, you might say, early state so that they didn't become advanced diseases. And so this was just a part of life. Every kid, every mother, they knew what you needed to take to fix most health problems. It was just part of the culture. It wasn't anything special. And wouldn't it be nice when people know how to grow food and help keep their environment healthy and themselves healthy, just as a matter of course. It's just like common knowledge. It's nothing special. You know, it's eventually where we hope we're going to get to.
It is the world that I'd like to see. With everything that we've covered today, Michael, is there anything else that you'd like to add to the conversation that you have notes written down that you'd like to make sure that the listeners hear?
Yeah, well, I noticed that one thing I talked about, you know, if we started putting permaculture into action and all these houses and rentals, et cetera, and everybody had a really nice place where they lived, I'd really like to put in a call for having every school should have a school garden, like in South Africa, where permaculture is part of the school curriculum, and people learn how to grow food. They don't just learn how to work in factories and work for the man. They learn how to, you know, give a man a fish instead of teaching him how to get on welfare or get a job. So schools should really be incorporating permaculture in school gardens. They should be really great places to be. A lot of our schools now outwardly resemble, prisons. And same with hospitals. All hospitals should have great gardens or farms associated with them so that the people there can get really good nutritious food and that there's pleasant gardens to go out in and so that the hospital itself becomes a healing place. Right now, the hospital situation is pretty dire with most of the food isn't very good. And the other thing is old folks' homes or places where we currently stick our elders, they should have gardens. They should be lovely places. They should be, you know, there should be great gardens and places for people to pick their own food and shade and sun, and just everybody should have the opportunity to live in a wonderful surroundings filled with nutritious and tasty food and beauty and fragrances and color. Everybody should have that as part of their lives. And if everybody did, there'd be a whole lot less diseases in the world. There'd be a whole lot less pain. There wouldn't be a need for the resource wars. There wouldn't be the need for a lot of criminal activity where, because people have nothing or they're trying to numb themselves from the horrible society they live in by taking bad drugs, etc. There's healing the earth and healing the people are two of the big jobs in the world today. And so my hat is off for people that will take that on as part of what they, part of what they're going to devote their life to. I mean, some people devote their lives to making money or just having a job. They don't have a real clear mission. They don't have a clear sense of how they're contributing to the whole. And so I hope that everybody out there will find their niche, their way that they can be productive and helpful and help create this better world that we know can happen and that we're so far away from. At any rate, I'm wishing everybody well out there, though.
Well, thank you for all that, Michael, and every story that we share, every message that my listeners and others hear helps us get one step closer to that better world.
Yeah, and like I said, go out and learn what the useful wild plants in your area are. It's a great, you can take classes, you can get books, you can look at YouTube. There's a lot of ways to get information these days. But you can just wander around out there and just start observing. You know, observation is just such a big part of permaculture. And so go out, observe. And as a wild crafter, and maybe I might throw this in there, as a wild crafter out there gathering things in the woods, a lot of times I see things I can do to help make a resource stronger. I can collect seeds from these plants in this area and spread them over there in appropriate ecosystems. I can help expand the resource. Sustainable wildcrafting isn't just taking, it's increasing the resource. Another thing that just came just back from the Montana herb gathering where we talk about these things, and it was really strongly pointed out that, you know, in some places we have too many of these what we call invasive noxious weeds from elsewhere, and there's less room for native plants if there's too many of them. A lot of those invasive noxious plants have medicinal or edible uses. We can go out there and actually, in a sense, we can over-harvest them in a way so that they become less of the landscape so we have more room for the natives. So wildcrafting can inhibit some things and encourage others. And that's the kind of the mindset, the restoration and the wildcrafting going in permaculture. How do we sort of nudge the ecosystem towards being more productive and having more biodiversity and reducing erosion, et cetera. So there's all these little things we can do. Some things are big, some things are little. Fixing up the earth sounds really daunting, but fixing up the acre or the half acre of the yard I'm living on is not that daunting. So if everybody just fixes up where they're at, pretty soon everywhere's fixed up. Do as much as you can.
Thank you for all of that, Michael, and taking this time to sit down and talk with me.
All right, Scott, and all the rest of you, good luck. And if you haven't taken a permaculture design course yet, I recommend it to help give you the skills to be able to do this stuff.
And that was Michael Pilarski. One of the things that stood out to me from this conversation, and it's funny to say that with all these interviews because there's a lot more information than I point out in these notes of mine, but what I really liked was when Mr. Pilarski was talking about the imperative about us taking care of that little place around us and fixing it up, that as each of us do that, the world becomes a better place. As permaculture practitioners, I think of David Holmgren and his desire for us to build working models and to spread permaculture by showing people that it works, that if we just take a little bit of time, build up the space around us, that we can do that. There's also Sam Thayer and Arthur Haynes telling us to get out there and go forage.
that what Wilson and Ben are doing to tend the wild is a way to show an example of not only how to live within the ethics of permaculture and our interactions with the world that supports us, but also a way to continue civilization and the things we like about it in the process, while also being able to earn a viable income. I feel like we're on the cusp of a pretty powerful transition, that as much as is going on in the world, each of us are embodying the change that we want and are beginning to see it. But maybe that's just my bias because I like this world we live in and the possibilities of it all. What do you dream about when you think about permaculture and what can be done with it? Which dreams are you taking action on right now? I'd love to hear from you. You can reach me via email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or by phone, 717-827-6266. And if there's anything that I can do to help you in your road with permaculture, feel free to contact me at either of those. And next week will be Dave Jackie, co-author, along with Eric Tonesmeyer of Edible Forest Gardens. After that is Robert Currick, author of multiple books important to permaculture, including Designing and Maintaining Your Edible Landscape Naturally. And after Mr. Currick, Bob Tice returns to continue discussing natural building materials and techniques, and we round out the month with Larry Santoyo. And that's going to bring things to a close for this episode. If you'd like to receive regular updates from the show and participate in the conversation, you can do that by liking the Permaculture Podcast on Facebook or following me on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other, and that little bit of legal. The Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivatives, Non-Commercial license. Feel free to share it. Just let people know where you got it, and don't change or sell it.